Welcome to the American Cafe. I'm your host, Ira Melman. In the search for new food sources, the United States is starting to pick up on eating crickets.
Basically, you're getting the really great part of the cricket, if you will, the chicken breast part.
Tom Bonsi makes a cafe appearance from Portland, Oregon. From Los Angeles, Elizabeth Lee has words about how the United States is falling behind in the way it treats its working women.
I have friends who live in Europe. I have friends who live in Asia and even in Canada. And when they hear about our system, they're always horrified and shocked.
And Carol Pearson introduces us to Resounding Earth.
Altogether, Resounding Earth incorporates over 350 metal objects, ranging from tiny cluster bells to huge Chinese gongs.
All of that and more on this week's American Cafe. Whether it's fried caterpillars in Tanzania, chili-roasted grasshoppers in Mexico, or crunchy giant water bugs in Thailand, the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization estimates insects are a normal part of the diet of at least 2 billion people worldwide. Now, well over a dozen startups are hoping that squeamish Americans and Europeans will open their minds and their mouths as well. Correspondent Tom Bonsi brings us the story of an Oregon company that has started selling finely ground crickets as human food.
The company's name is Cricket Flours. That's flour as in the white, powdery foodstuff. Founder and CEO Charles Wilson says he got interested in crickets as a protein supplement when he found out he had food sensitivities to dairy, gluten, and a bunch of other ingredients.
And one of them was actually in the protein powder that I was using, you know, to build muscle, and I'd used for swimming and gymnastics. And, you know, I'd always used it, but found I wasn't supposed to have it anymore. So started looking for alternative proteins and alternative food ingredients, and I stumbled across cricket flour.
Wilson says he recognized more than a replacement for his protein shakes. He sensed a business opportunity. At the time, Wilson was attending the University of Oregon's law school. He approached a friend who was studying at the business school. Omar Ellis distinctly remembers their conversation last year.
And I was like, well, what's the idea? And he's like, well, I want to sell protein powder made from crickets. And you could literally hear crickets at that point because I'm like, what? Like, really? I don't think that's going to work, Charles. I just spent my first year in business school, you know, basically doing a lot of market research, and my intuition is that's going to fail horribly.
But Wilson was persuasive. Ellis became a co-founder and executive at Cricket Flours, and now he's out and about chirping the reasons to eat food made from insects.
It's got more iron than spinach, more calcium than milk.
Recently, he was offering product samples in the atrium of a sustainability conference in Portland, Oregon.
Why crickets? They're very sustainable. They take one-tenth the feed and one-sixth the water to get the same amount of protein that you'd get from beef. It's quite amazing.
Ellison Wilson's business buys dried, milled crickets in bulk from several U.S. wholesalers. The entrepreneurs resell the pure cricket flour online, as well as chocolate-flavored and baking mixes. The insect origins of the foods are unrecognizable without a label after processing. Conference-goers Amy Jarvis and Ben Kotoko were game to try cricket powder mixed into spiced granola.
Well, it's a little bit disconcerting. Clearly not going to work for a vegetarian. But ultimately, there's a problem finding good protein powders that are not flavored, and this isn't.
In any other form, I would never do this. But, you know, definitely it might be something for the future. You never know.
After that buildup, I had to try myself. Ellis offered a tasting cup of the special granola.
When we get the powder, there's no antennas and no legs on them. Those things are sifted off before they're even milled. So it's basically you're getting the really great part of the cricket, if you will, the chicken breast part, kind of.
All right, well, let's see what I think here and if I can taste it. Now, I'm getting mostly the granola taste here. There's really nothing off or unusual, really, about it.
Yep. No. Cool. Yeah, you can't think of it as eating crickets. You have to think of it as, I'm just going to intake a lot more protein now.
Business partner Charles Wilson describes the pure ground-up crickets as having a neutral taste, maybe in the slightly nutty direction. Cricket Flours is one of more than a dozen North American startups in the edible insects niche. Others are focused on cricket farming or selling energy bars or snacks made with cricket powder. Ellis says it takes around 5,000 crickets to make a pound of flour. That makes the end product, whatever it is, relatively expensive. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Portland, Oregon.
It was almost 20 years ago that representatives of 189 countries met at a UN conference in Beijing and adopted a plan of action to achieve gender equality around the world. Now, two decades later, the University of California, Los Angeles World Policy Analysis Center has issued a report examining what the Beijing Platform for Action has achieved. While the report does highlight advances in some areas, it also points to places around the world where full equality has not been achieved, including the United States, where it says there is still a lack of adequate maternal leave policies. From Los Angeles, Elizabeth Lee joins us with the story.
A private school teacher who wants to be identified only as Barbara because she's worried about repercussions for speaking out is expecting her second child and is worried about making ends meet.
Most private schools do not have a maternity leave program because they're too small and it's too expensive.
Barbara can use 20 days of her paid sick and vacation leave, but if she has to take time off after that, she would not be paid. She says the solution is disability insurance, but that would only pay a percentage of her income when she's not working.
I was insulted that, having a child, bringing into the society another productive member who will be paying taxes their whole life and working for the betterment of their society, hopefully, that there was no thought behind the label of, you're disabled because you're having a child. That seemed to be sort of crass to me.
Similar experiences are not uncommon in the United States, says Jody Hyman, founder of the University of California, Los Angeles's World Policy Analysis Center.
While 188 countries, that's virtually every country, has paid maternity leave, the United States now really just with Papua New Guinea, Suriname, six small South Pacific Island states are the only countries without it.
U.S. law requires employers to provide 12 weeks of unpaid leave. Companies with fewer than 50 employees are exempt because for some businesses, paying for maternity leave is a financial hardship, says Chris Tilley, who heads the UCLA Institute for Research on Labor and Employment.
Saying, we should be able to have families and raise families, and we should be able to retire, those are social needs, not necessarily business needs. So from a business viewpoint, it doesn't necessarily make sense to fund these things. Businesses have resisted.
A few states do have their own paid family leave programs. California, the first statewide program in the U.S., pays 55% of a person's wages for up to 6 weeks of time off through the state's disability insurance program. Jody Hyman says federal legislation to mandate paid maternity leave is necessary because a woman's parenting role is connected to an income gap.
While single women who have never married have earnings that look a lot like men in the United States, moms earn 76 cents on the dad's dollar. So that's where the real gap is.
But before paid maternity leave becomes federal law in the U.S., a cultural shift may be necessary, says Professor Tilley.
And part of the cultural shift is that our allergy to big government regulations stands in the way of trying to decide as a society, how do we make families work?
I have friends who live in Europe. I have friends who live in Asia and even in Canada. And when they hear about our system, they're always horrified and shocked.
For now, Barbara has no choice but to hope her disability insurance and her husband's income will be enough to pay the bills while she takes time off to recover from childbirth and care for her newborn. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Sometimes you can feel the clear sound of a bell from your head to your feet. Take that idea and think big, and you may have an idea of what Augusta Reed Thomas is trying to do with Resounding Earth. The piece is scored exclusively for metals and features more than 125 bells from a wide variety of cultures and historic periods. VOA's June So has more on this unique percussion work.
For award-winning American composer Augusta Reed Thomas, this is the sound of the earth.
I've always been attracted to bell-like sounds. The title, Resounding Earth, on the one hand, we're talking about resounding earth, this earth that is full of metals that all of mankind has turned into instruments, and we're going to play them from all around the world together on one stage.
Thomas says her composition is like a United Nations of resonances.
Yeah, these are Indian Noah bells or Katki.
On a recent Sunday, the members of Third Coast Percussion were setting up the instruments to rehearse Resounding Earth. The Chicago-based quartet was invited to perform the piece at the National Gallery of Art in Washington. Peter Martin is one of the musicians.
We have bells that come from India. We have gongs that come from Thailand. We have other bells that come from all over the European continent. Literally every continent, I believe, is represented in the instrumentation.
Some are locally found objects.
It is a spring coil from heavy machinery. Makes a beautiful sound. It's not built to be a musical instrument, but it makes a beautiful sound.
Altogether, Resounding Earth incorporates over 350 metal objects, ranging from tiny cluster bells to huge Chinese gongs. Thomas developed the piece in close collaboration with the Third Coast percussionists.
It was very challenging, yeah, just being able to figure out the distinct sound qualities of each one of the instruments and then to be able to play them in a way that sort of balanced them across each other. And that was both a difficulty for ourselves as performers, but also for the composer herself, who was trying to craft a piece.
Martin says the 35-minute opus was many years in the making, and every move of the players was carefully choreographed. The work has four movements. One is scored exclusively for 26 Japanese rins, or singing bowls, creating a meditative sound. 18 Burmese spinning bells, traditionally played by monks, are a central component of another section.
But it's also resounding earth, you know, to take what's in the earth and resound it. And in that sense, it's really giving it back to the earth, giving it back to the people. It's been a very beautiful journey.
The composer and the players say they would love to take the music to all the places where the bells were made and share their resonance with people around the world. For producer June So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
More than 3 years after the death of Apple Computer co-founder Steve Jobs, the inventor and businessman has inspired a new book, Becoming Steve Jobs, The Evolution of a Reckless Upstart into a Visionary Leader. Through interviews and the people who knew Jobs best, the book portrays a human picture of someone who accomplished something extraordinary. As Faiza Al-Masri tells us in this piece narrated by Faith Lapidus.
In 2009, senior Apple executive Tim Cook approached Steve Jobs, his ailing boss, mentor, and friend, who was on a waiting list for a liver transplant, with a generous offer.
He had actually offered his liver to Steve Jobs, and Jobs said no.
This is one of the stories that technology reporter Rick Tetzeli shares in the book, Becoming Steve Jobs, which he wrote with business journalist Brent Schlender.
Cook told us the story because he thought it was a story that showed how Jobs was not a selfish man. But it was also a story that showed us how intense the relationships were between Jobs and his key lieutenants.
Through stories like that, Tetzeli says, he and Schlender tried to explore many elements of Jobs' personality. He was often described as difficult and obsessive over the smallest details in the designs of his products.
If you worked closely with Steve Jobs, you had stood up to him. He dismissed people who did not fight for their ideas. So he fought with all his close executives. It was the natural sort of debate that he thought would lead to the best products. So he could be difficult, but he also took a very personal interest in people's personal lives. He understood how to motivate people. Money was important, and the people who worked for him closely made a lot of money. But it was much more about the quality of your work, doing the best work you possibly could do. And even people who got fired by him or who ended their relationships with him badly all say they did the best work of their lives while working for him.
The authors also interviewed Bill Gates, Microsoft co-founder, inventor, and philanthropist. Tetzeli says the relationship between the two tech entrepreneurs evolved over the years, from one of competition to friendship.
There was a lot of competition. I mean, they both said awful things about each other over the course of their careers. But remember, Bill Gates left, the last time he was CEO of Microsoft was in the year 2000. So he was not so much of a direct competitor with Apple during the last 11 years of Jobs' life. And over that time, since they weren't competing so directly, they were able to sort of express their admiration for one another more than they had in the past.
He says Steve Jobs himself changed over time. The man who ran Apple in its early days and was forced to leave the company in 1985 was very different from the man who came back in 1997 to lead the same company and shepherd it to success unlike anything the business world had ever seen.
He was not a man who was very retrospective. He didn't look back much in his life, but he did say that he was incredibly lucky to get a second chance at Apple. And he had learned a lot in the years away. He had tried some things during those years away that didn't work, but he had learned a lot.
By looking closely at his life and work, Tetzeli says one can recognize two important components of Steve Jobs' legacy.
Technologically, the iPhone is the pinnacle of his career. It's the most important device he created. It changes the way we think of technology. It makes technology a mobile thing in a way that it never had been before. It is a profound, profound change from a world where our technology just sits at a desk. In terms of his legacy, I think that he worked really hard in his last few years to set up Apple for success, to create systems and ways of thinking that would live on after his death. And when you consider that Apple is more than twice as big as when he died and is still engaged in risky, inspired things like the Apple Watch, I think that Apple, the incredibly strong company we now know, is his greatest legacy.
Tetzeli says he hopes young inventors reflect on Steve Jobs' journey to understand the secrets behind his success.
You should be open to ideas from all over the place. Jobs was not a narrow thinker. He was a very focused man. He worked very hard. But his ideas came from all over the place. He got ideas from his executives. He got ideas from talking to people in other industries. He got ideas from things he read.
Becoming Steve Jobs co-author Rick Tetzeli says that's what he hopes young readers will take away from the book. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
What began as a graduate thesis project to develop an outdoor education program grew into the Cottonwood Institute, a nonprofit that offers underserved teenagers in Denver, Colorado, a path to leadership that leads through the outdoors. Paula Vargas explains how the Institute ignites student involvement in protecting the environment.
Getting teens to do their homework, good luck. Getting them outdoors, into the mountains, to research solutions for environmental problems, that, it turns out, is not that difficult, as New Vista High School senior Juliet Luna explains.
Getting kids out into the environment inspires them to protect it, because if you don't know what you're protecting, why would you bother?
That's the Cottonwood Institute's mission. Working with teachers, it supports programs that incorporate environmental projects into local school curricula. As a class, the students select an environmental issue to work on, look for solutions, and team up with local environmentalists to implement those changes. After the 6 to 12 week long program, they have a better understanding of what it takes to have a meaningful impact, and, says senior Jaden Gomez, a broader base of knowledge.
I've learned a lot about CCD, which is colony collapse disorder, which has to do with the disappearance of bees. I've also learned a lot about fracking and water pollution.
Along with community adventure programs, which takes students on hikes and overnight camping trips, the Cottonwood Institute supports a program that involves students in developing projects to help reduce their school's environmental footprint. Cottonwood Institute founder Ford Church says he wants these teens to think about future generations.
The big thing that's important for us is making sure that our students take care of the land that we're exploring. In the city, you might drop trash on the ground and it's not a big deal, and that's a big deal to us because this is our playground, this is our office, so to speak, and we really want to take care of it.
For students like Jaden and his classmate Cassidy Lamb, it's a chance to experience how one person can make a difference.
It just felt like all of the things that are happening to our planet that are negative feels so big and impossible for me to change. But while getting involved in this program, I realized that it's actually really easy to take it step by little step.
It's really good to learn about the ecology and learn about the issues that we cause on the environment and how we can work on that and try to fix that.
Last year, the decade-old Institute served 415 students, guiding them through nearly 5,000 hours of projects, giving them a chance to explore the outdoors and make a difference in their community. For VOA News, Paula Vargas in Denver.
That is all the time we have for American Cafe, and we hope you have enjoyed our daily as well as our weekend programs. Our thanks to executive producer Bob Doty, who has worked tirelessly on this project. And yes, we would still like to hear from you. Send us an email from wherever you are to our studios here in Washington, D.C. Email us at americancafe@voanews.com. For all the people here at VOA, I'm Ira Melman. Thank you for joining us in the American Cafe.